My dad was just having a regular day and he got a phone call. I was out of the house and it said that these people were screaming on the phone and they told him that they'd kidnapped me. And because I've put myself out there, he believed it. He was like, she's out there on the internet. Like, people found her and they're holding her hostage. So they were screaming at him that they've kidnapped me. There was a woman on the other side of the phone screaming. And they said that they were gonna kill me if he didn't like listen to everything they said.
This week, I spoke to former US national security expert for the Pentagon, Ashley Stohr. During Ashley's time working in counterterrorism for the United States Department of Defense, she was only in her early 20s. We spoke about the lessons and experiences she gained, as well as how this time in her life helped shape her and allow her to realize what she really wanted from her life. Ashley is now a career coach, author, podcast host, and a speaker. Her TEDx speech on figuring out what you want has been viewed over 6.1 million times. Ashley now helps people find their purpose and become their most authentic selves to pursue what they really enjoy doing and not stay in a place or a situation where they're unhappy. I hope you get a lot from this. Let's get into it. So I was one of those people who listened to your TEDx speech, and I wanted to know what led you on the path that you are now to becoming a career coach.
You know, it's not like I came out of the womb thinking like I should be giving career advice. But if you look at my path in counterterrorism, what it's really about is understanding where people are lying. That's how you survive working in national security, is being able to understand people and understand where there is incongruence, where somebody's saying one thing or doing another, or they're saying something, but it doesn't actually feel like they mean it. And your survival when you work in national security comes from that. And so for me as a career coach now, having worked in national security in my 20s, I learned how to spot lies. And I think that's what the problem is for so many people in their career, is that they're not being honest with themselves, or they just don't know who they are. And as a result, they are committing to paths and choices that aren't necessarily aligned with who they truly are. And so even though counterterrorism and my first career path feels kind of like a red herring, I think it really prepared me well to be intuitive, to understand humans, and to really understand the core of what makes people make sense for themselves. And also notice where people are off kilter.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I want to strip it back slightly because I'm really intrigued about your career in counterterrorism. And you were in that career at a very young age, in your early 20s. So I want to know, like, what did you learn from that? And what was that experience like for you?
I learned it wasn't the right fit for me, but, I don't know. I think like a lot of people, I went to college. I didn't know what I was going to major in. I went to the career services office. She said all the three worded things like follow your passion, or like do what you love, or follow your bliss. I don't even know, you know, those things. And I remember feeling more confused when I left than when I came in. And I just chose things that I was interested in, on the hope that my interest would translate into a path that was fulfilling. And what I've learned over the years is that being interested in something doesn't mean you have skill, a natural set of skill in that thing. I am a happy consumer of a lot of things. I love fashion. I like politics. I like food, but it doesn't mean I like massages, but it doesn't mean that I'm meant to be a producer of those things in my career. And I think that's the line of thinking that gets people stuck, is they think, oh, I love food. That doesn't mean you should own a bakery. I love fashion. That doesn't mean you should be a fashion designer. Having an interest in something does not mean necessarily having a skill set in that thing. How you harness your energy throughout the day, your mind, your body, your heart, that comes down to a skill set. That comes down to a natural ability. And I think what we've been taught in our careers is to lead with our interests. So for me in college, going into career service, I picked three majors, not because I'm an overachiever, but because I just really was not clear. I was commitment phobic in my career. Like, I don't want to pick one thing, because what if I don't it's not the right thing. So I picked government, I picked history, I picked French. And I just thought maybe one of these will paint me a picture into a path that I want. And I also grew up during 9/11. I feel like in the same way that COVID has influenced Generation Z, 9/11, I think, impacted millennial generation with our career choices. You know, we graduated, we got a lot of college debt, and we kind of ran off the cliff of the recession in 2008. I was pretty excited about my career. And then when I graduated, I couldn't get a job to save my life. I was on my parents' couch for way too long and applying and hearing crickets. But what I do know was during 9/11, I had family on the East Coast. I was really impacted by that happening. And I wanted to do something. And I've always had a nurturer and a protector inside of me. And so I think that was like the highest way I could think of nurturing and protecting was like, I'm going to protect at the national level. I don't know. And so I went in and I gave my all to it. And I think like a lot of people, once you have a plan, it feels like a nice, safe little place to hide, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just held on to my plan for the sake of it, for the sake of having something to say at cocktail parties or at college parties. When somebody had asked me who I'm going to be when I grow up, I had something to say for better or for worse. But what I was missing was that, you know, who you are always wins. So even if you hold on to a plan, if it's a Band-Aid, if you're just putting something on so that you have something, eventually you're going to have to rip it. And so for me, I eventually got honest with myself and realized, well, you know, just because I'm a good writer or I'm a good communicator does not mean that I'm meant to be writing in counterterrorism. In fact, it's a completely different skill set. What I didn't understand, and this is something I read about in my book, U-Turn, is I find that there's largely 10 core skill sets, and I talk about them in chapter 2. And I obviously don't want to box people into 10 different boxes because there's more to a human than 10 boxes. But one of the core skill sets is words, and another one is analysis. And words is my core skill set. So when I looked at being an intelligence analyst or working in counterterrorism, I was like, oh, wow, I get to write all day. That's perfect, writing intelligence reports. But what I missed was that there's a highly analytical component to that role. And being analytical, I'm using the literal opposite side of my brain that I use as a writer. As a writer, I'm very creative. As an analyst, being analytical is just a different thought field. And so I misinterpreted my own core skill set when I went into counterterrorism. And I think a lot of people do that.
Thank you to this week's podcast sponsor, Orange County CBD, a multiple award-winning company who have recently partnered up with the CALM charity. Now, CALM stands for Campaign Against Living Miserably. Their aim is to take a stand against suicide and provide help for those struggling. Orange County CBD are kindly donating 10 Peter CALM for every item sold. I'd personally recommend the CBD Muscle and Joint Balm, which has really helped my aches and pains from training. If it's your thing, then check out their Instagram at orange.county.cbd and their website, orangecounty-cbd.com. Why do you think they do that? Why do you think people get into that habit of being in a comfort zone and just settling?
I think your comfort zone is quite comfortable, you know? So it's
a nice place to be.
Yeah, it's awesome. Sometimes I'm hanging out in my comfort zone. I'm like, I want to stay here. It feels so, it feels so calm. And I think that's why success, successful people, they're just willing to do what other people aren't, you know, being successful and working hard and putting yourself out there. It's a lot on your nervous system. You have to put yourself out. You kind of have to be crazy, right? Because you push yourself. There was a coach that I once had named Dan Sullivan, and he used to say, fear is wetting your pants and courage is doing what you're supposed to do with wet pants. So I'm just sitting here with you on this podcast with a bunch of wet pants, just doing what I can do out of my comfort zone, because most people, this is the human experience. I studied psychology, and here's what I found is there's two core dynamics. There's fear of the unknown, which is very human. And then there's misery in your current state, right? And these are like two levers. So when most people won't make a change until their misery is so bad that they're like, I don't even care about the unknown anymore. I'm going to go straight into it because this misery is intolerable. Mm. And in my case, I've just learned that when something feels kind of lukewarm, I don't need to be like a wrecking ball in my life and run amok and run off to an island or something, but I can ask questions, you know, and start to get honest with myself about what I really want and who I really am. And what that's looked like for me is saying, you know, I'm feeling lukewarm about this, and why? What's missing? And I don't know, I think there's some toxicity in the personal self-improvement, self-development field where there's a lot of mindset around work on yourself and improve yourself and be better. And I'm all for it. But sometimes the real work is self-acceptance. Sometimes the real work is not being better. Sometimes the real work is saying, how do I love myself as I am? And so what I mean here, when I look at my life and I don't buy into this, these two levers of letting myself be so freaking miserable that then I'm willing to go into the unknown, I'm willing to say, okay, when something feels lukewarm, I've built a mindset and a pattern with myself where there's an inner alarm system that says, like, okay, this feels lukewarm and I'm just going to get curious. And so I've learned to get curious and ask questions when things aren't feeling right and be willing to go into the unknown as a way of life. Vulnerability, I think, is a life decision. And people who are listening right now, it's like, do you want to be vulnerable or not? It's a way you live. Yeah. And it's a choice. It's an action every day, just like authenticity. It happens in moments, and it's a string of moments where you're choosing to be yourself. And it's uncomfortable, you know? So going back to that comfort zone, like, I would love to put on a mask, and sometimes I will. The difference is that I have enough self-awareness most of the time, not all the time, to say, oh, I'm putting on a little mask right now. You know, most people, the mask is living them. They're not choosing the mask. And so I think the beginning and the opening into being more of yourself is saying, where am I feeling off? Where is my peace disturbed? And just start asking questions. Like, what is it about this that doesn't feel right? Even looking at your phone, looking at your text messages and saying, where am I feeling an energy leak? Where am I feeling like I'm losing energy? If you just look at people's names, you'll start to see where your energy goes up or down. If you look at your inbox on your email and different projects you're doing, you'll notice where you expand and where you contract. And there's a lot of intelligence to that, right? Like, you know, our bodies are our feedback mechanisms. Our gut has 200 million neurons. That's why they call it the second brain. There is an intelligence to your stomach sinking and to you getting a nudge or butterflies towards something. So I don't know if this answers your question or if I'm just going on a tangent over here, but hopefully that's helpful.
No, I think you're right. I think we're very intelligent beings, and without even knowing that we know when something's off. And I think a lot of people realized that during the lockdowns, where they had a lot of time to, I think, just rest and reset and realize what they really want in life. And it might be a career change. It might be a change in, I don't know, relationship. They realize actually it's not working, or a change in a friendship. Like you said, if you're talking to people and if they're giving you energy or they're draining you, you kind of have to make that decision to make yourself have a better life, if that makes sense. So, yeah. But I think we get to a point, don't we, where we try and embark on something new, and then we tell ourselves a little story that we're not worthy or we're not capable of doing it. And then we start self-sabotaging. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, I think we come into the world with a thermometer, and it's set often by our caretakers. We learn, and this is just from studying psychology, that I've learned, you know, most of our beliefs about the world are set around age 7 to 12, about love, about money, about success, about work, about people. There's like a thermostat that we get from our parents. And unless we look at that thermostat and say, like, what are we set at? We are kind of in a default setting. And so the conversation in my house about success, I remember actually my dad sat me down and he said, you know, money in your career, it's like a, what did he say? It was like a carousel or a roller coaster. And he was implying that getting a salary at a job is a carousel. You go around and around and you collect your check, and there's nothing wrong with that. And then being an entrepreneur, he told me, was like a roller coaster. You have high highs, low lows. Well, I've met a lot of entrepreneurs over the years that just are very even keeled. They don't have high highs and low lows. They have steady growth and stability in their business. And I hadn't even considered that possibility. And so what happens when your life comes up against the edge of your thermostat is, unless you've questioned it, unless you've noticed it, unless you've cultivated awareness around it, you will start to self-sabotage. This reminds me a lot of the book, The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks. He talks about this phenomenon of an upper limit problem. And he argues that a lot of us have an upper limit problem where his question that he asks is, are you willing to let it be this good? Have you read that book by chance?
I don't think I have, no.
Yeah, it's a great book. He talks about, you know, how most people get uncomfortable when things are really good. And we all have an upper limit inside of us. Mm. And after we cross that threshold, we will tend to self-sabotage because it's just not comfortable. And so I think it is so important to ask yourself, if you're listening right now, what was the conversation like in your household about success, about, you know, money, about love? What did you learn about love? What did you watch? You know, what did your dad say, or your mom, or your caretaker when they came home from work? You know, I heard, you know, my dad used to say, like, money doesn't grow on trees. And I'd say, yeah, it does. It's paper. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like everybody has different beliefs, and it starts with your upbringing.
Massively. So how do you just define success?
And when I used to define it as a kid through making a lot of money and being important in some way, like society thinking you're really cool.
Yeah.
I used to want to be famous, and now I'm like, which is very like, doesn't make sense, because I wrote a whole book about my life with career advice in it for people, but I actually don't want to be famous now. So it's, that came from my thermostat. That came from wanting to mean something or be someone. Now I just want to write. I want to write. I want to think. I want to feel. I want to learn. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah, it does. It's interesting how perspectives of success change as you get older and you experience these different things. And I want to go back slightly to your career in counterterrorism. You realized it didn't work out for you. And something interesting I read, and I really like this, you said it wasn't a breakdown, it was actually a breakthrough, because it made you realize what you wanted in life. So how long were you in counterterrorism for before you decided to leave? And what's the catalyst to make you leave?
My transition was a lot of years. I mean, first of all, I went to graduate school. I learned multiple languages. I learned Dari, which is spoken in Afghanistan, Arabic, which is very rusty at this point. And then I became bilingual in French because I'd studied North Africa and they speak French there. I put everything into that path. And so there's a lot of years invested. And I think this is a problem for a lot of people, is that the law of sunken investment, or whatever that theory is. I'm not a theorist over here, but I would say, you know, that's a very real thing where people put a lot of time into something and then they hold on to it. But to me, that is a prison, because first of all, who you are is so much bigger than what you do. And if you want to hold yourself hostage in a career path forever because of the 4 years you invested in medical school or law school or whatever, then so be it. But unless you're like in your 90s, I don't want to hear that it's too late, because it's not. The time you will spend course correcting and the fulfillment, the ROI you will get in being honest with yourself, in changing things up. Your career. Here's the thing. I feel like the equivalent of what we're doing right now to people in their career is kind of like if in preschool, my mom said to me, the first guy you have a crush on, marry him. You know, that's what people are doing in their career. They're like, the first thing I find, I need to build on it.
Yeah.
Or the first decision I make that I invest in, I need to keep it going. And that to me is such an unfulfilling life. People are living too much on the goal line, where they're putting their success as a science. I need to do this and then get success. For me now, success is not in being someone. Success is in being who I am. And that's a writer. It's kind of a loner. Like, you know, I spend a lot of hours alone at coffee shops and thinking. And so if you want to be successful, which to me means being who you are and getting paid for it so that you can participate in this very human material world and be compensated for you, you have to be willing to enter an experiment. It's so rare that people just kind of come in and make their first shot and it's right. So yeah, I guess that would be my message on that.
That's really interesting. And it alludes to your TEDx speech, which I watched a couple of times. I literally watched it 20 minutes before we started speaking. And it was the TEDx speech with over 6.1 million views, which is amazing in itself. But it was the conversation about taking your power away. And it alluded to a story about your dad. Are you okay sharing that with the listener?
Yeah, absolutely. Just the story of what happened with my dad.
Yeah, the story of what happened and what you learned from that experience.
Yeah. It's funny. My dad actually he cries when he watches my TED talk because he doesn't like to think about that story because it was a horrible thing for him. But
I can imagine.
Ironically, when I was working in national security, I was trained at the FBI headquarters in Los Angeles, and they talked a lot about all sorts of different kidnapping scenarios. And one of the most common ones is a fake kidnapping where scammers and, you know, from wherever they are, will call and they'll run through a phone list and they'll say, we have your daughter or we have your son. And they'll have somebody screaming in the background and they just keep calling until they get someone who has a daughter or a son that's not with them. And we're going to kill them if you don't listen to us. And they scam them for money and to pay for them to get free and ransom and all that stuff. So I was actually exposed to some information about kidnapping. I ended up working in the private sector after the Department of Defense, running a threat team. And a lot of kidnapping issues had presented themselves. So it's ironic that I actually know a lot about this, but my dad was just having a regular day and he got a phone call. I was out of the house and it said that these people were screaming on the phone and they told him that they'd kidnapped me. And because I've put myself out there, he believed it. He was like, she's out there on the internet. Like people found her and they're holding her hostage. So they were screaming at him that they've kidnapped me. There was a woman on the other side of the phone screaming. And they said that they were going to kill me if he didn't listen to everything they said. And so I'm really impressed because my dad in that moment on the phone, I mean, first of all, you think about your brain from a psychology standpoint, that's his amygdala, his fight or flight, which was completely captured in that moment. So you can't think clearly when your amygdala is captured. And he did a pretty good job being in a crisis. So they said that they're holding me hostage. And he stopped everything he was doing and listened to everything they said. And they said, we need you to go to the bank. We need you to wire us money. And we're going to leave her in this, you know, parking lot. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm recording a podcast episode for my show, the U-Turn podcast, and in my office. And I'm so not kidnapped. And he even had me on Find My Friends on his iPhone and he saw where I was, but he like his amygdala, his brain.
Yeah.
So he just listened and they got him all the way to the bank. And then the police called me and they said, are you kidnapped? And I was like, no. And then he just barely didn't wire them funds. So yeah, he ended up getting on the phone with me and having a bit of a little breakdown, which is, makes sense. And I remember driving home to keep him company because he was so shaken up and he was ready to send them his life savings. And I spent the evening with him and I just journaled a lot, thought about these kidnappers and thought about how crazy it is. What a weird career path as someone who's a career coach now, like what a weird decision. Like why would somebody decide to scare the life out of someone in exchange for money? There's so many ways to make money. So many jobs out there. I met a taste tester the other day. I mean, there's really a lot of jobs. So if that's the case, you know, why would somebody do that? And I just felt this compassion for them. I was like, that's insane. They must feel cornered. They must feel like they don't have a better way to make money or they're desperate and they're surrendering their life over to this really dark way of making money. And so then I thought, well, you know what? I'm no different than them. I'm my own kidnapper. I made myself do all sorts of weird stuff in my career that wasn't very me. And I think we all are. I think we all hold ourselves hostage in relationships, in different scenarios as a way to keep ourselves small, as a way to avoid our upper limit, as a way to be comfortable. You know, your comfort zone is a great place. It's just not optimal for you to really become who you are. And so, yeah, that's my little TED Talk story. And really gave me a lot to think about as a career person, helping people self-actualize.
I think that's amazing how you felt compassion for those people who were trying to scam you and your father. Like, where did you learn that compassion? Is that something you've always had built in you, or is that something you kind of developed throughout your career?
I think that in order to have compassion, you need to have capacity.
Okay.
And what that means for me is, if you haven't sat with yourself and all of your grief, all of your trauma, and I mean, not all of, that's kind of extreme thing to say, but really looked at your life,
yeah,
and sat with your pain, and you have not had compassion for yourself, you are not going to have capacity and bandwidth to have compassion for someone else. Why would you validate someone else's human experience if you haven't been willing to sit in the discomfort of your own? So my ability to see these kidnappers and say, like, wow, that's a lot, came from me looking at my own life, looking at my own heartbreak, looking at and letting that be a place where light can come in, where I can have more depth, have more awareness, have more willingness. And so, you know, one of my biggest portals in my own life was my sister who passed away. You know, I had a lot of grief with her as a kid. I knew as a kid, she wasn't going to live forever because she really didn't take care of herself. And I sat with that heartbreak for a lot of my life. And, you know, having a sibling that is, has a drug addiction and who dies young, sits with you, and grief moves. It finds its way. It has its way with you. It's a moving target. It's an ongoing process, you know? And so I think instead of pushing it down like a beach ball under the ocean and tiring myself, that's the thing about somatic experiences with your body is, according to research, you can pass through a feeling sometimes over 7 seconds, maybe a minute or two. So if you really let yourself feel that thing you really don't want to feel, it's usually a couple minutes. It's very rare that you're still crying a half hour later. Mm-hmm. And what's so great about that is it liberates you, because if you're not letting yourself feel something, you're throwing it down like a beach ball, you're not processing it. And you spend a lot of your life, you could spend 10 years holding a beach ball down versus just a couple minutes feeling it as it comes. And so I've learned that, you know, being compassionate with yourself is actually just a hack to being a little more effective and efficient in your life anyway, getting further with yourself and with everyone else.
And that's a huge thing to process and overcome, isn't it? Is heartbreak and grief. And I think it's probably one of the most difficult things in the world to sit with that emotion. Like you said, sit with those emotions and process those difficult things, as opposed to distracting yourself and possibly self-sabotaging yourself with whatever your goals are, because it's easy to wallow in it and become a victim of it and really, really hurt, but not know how to articulate it. So how did you start navigating your way through that to not overcome the grief, because I don't think you ever truly overcome grief, but get back on track and find your fulfillment again?
Yeah, I think, like, when your heart is broken, it's just open. I think that there's like a tenderness to being heartbroken, and I think there's a receptivity to it. And so I think there's a lot of power in heartbreak. I think there's a lot of power in loss. I think rock bottom is a very meaningful place. Great news about it is you can only go up. It's not like I'm like, you know, Mother Teresa over here, just like saturated with compassion. Obviously I'm still very human, but I've used it. I've used my grief. I've used my grief for my writing, my entire book U-Turn, which is an 11-step formula and roadmap to figuring out your career path. Very much so was a place for me to go process and share with the idea of serving others. And I think it's served me in a lot of ways. So I think, you know, there's a lot of cheesy online things that say, make your message or whatever you know, says, and I get it. I think there's something really potent about taking pain and turning it into gain. And you get to choose. You get to choose. You know, isn't it Winston Churchill? He said, when you're in hell, just keep walking. It sounds obvious, but a lot of people go into hell and they don't keep walking.
Yeah.
You know, they just stay in hell. It sounds like a bummer. So for me, I just use it. If I'm in it, I keep walking.
Are you of the belief that you use that grief and that fear that you have as almost fuel and motivation to then get back on track to be who you want to be and find that purpose?
Yes and no. I think I have a little too much feminine energy sometimes with grief. Okay. So like, I feel like masculine energy is, you know, and I think the trademark of an evolved person can walk through all energies, you know?
Yeah.
But I think masculine, that's very masculine to be like, this broke me down and I'm about to push through. Like,
yeah.
I think there's a time and a place for that. And I definitely have that in me. But I think when grief hits me, I let it have its way with me. And I talk to it sometimes. I'll just be like, you can do what you want. And I'll put the covers over my head and let it do it. Yeah. And I'll let myself have a day. And I think that's the difference. People who don't feel great, let yourself not feel great. It's not about marinating in it and identifying with it. See it as like, you're the sky and it's just the weather. It's just coming through. Yeah.
And that's the reason I asked that question, is because, yeah, you can have people who use it as fuel and use it to distract themselves and use it as great motivation. But the key word there is distraction. It can distract you and it's not necessarily a good thing. But I like what you're saying there. And I think that's a really positive message for not just people who are struggling with their mental health, but every person, that it's okay to have them days where you just, you know, lie around, sit around, maybe not only feel sorry for yourself, but be kind to yourself and know that it's okay to feel like that. Everyone feels like that. I think we're in a world where, and I said this on a number of podcasts, we're in a world and we go on social media and everyone's living their best lives. And then we're often like, okay, I'm not feeling great today. Why are they always happy? Is it a me thing? Am I the problem here? But then I heard a really good quote the other day. It's don't compare your behind the scenes to someone's highlight reel. And I thought, yeah, that is totally right. You know, because, you know, people are in this space where, okay, cool, they might not be having a great day. Don't feel you always have to be productive and always doing, like you said, you can just sit with that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think it was 2 weeks ago in January, 2022, Miss USA 2019, Chesley Chris, she jumped off the top of her building. She was an extra TV reporter, a very vibrant soul. We had a lot of mutual friends. People talked about how alive and wonderful she was.
Yeah.
So I think it's very real. And I'm definitely behind the scenes with a lot of influencers who are, you know, I think the amount of people, sad people in big houses with a lot of money is kind of a travesty. You know, I think the thing of money doesn't buy happiness, definitely buys a lot of lovely things. But you have to do your work on yourself. You know, I'm all for both, like make money and have happiness.
Yeah.
Like take a stand for the and, you know, but yeah, I think right now during the pandemic, people's mental health is the lowest I've ever seen in my personal practice. I've coached some people who it's surprised me what they're going through and not surprised me. So I think anyone listening, I'm an advocate for, mental health days. I'm an advocate for, admitting when you're burnt out, talking to your employer, going to see a psychiatrist if you need medicine. There are some forms of depression, anxiety, whatever you're going through, that is so much more than a meditation or a therapy call. You might need medication. You might need something to help you. And there's no shame in that. So, yeah.
So people listening now who want to get in touch with you to maybe have you coach them, I think the first question they'll probably come to you with is, all right, how do I find my purpose? And that's obviously the $1 million question that you're probably constantly asked, because people want to be happy, don't they? People want to get up every day and work on things that they enjoy doing. So how do you start getting people to get on that path?
Yeah. I mean, like, look, we spend 90,000 hours of our life at work. That's two-thirds of our time awake on this planet. So I understand the thought process that people want their career to matter. That being said, your purpose moves, you know. When I'm a mother, I'm guessing my purpose is going to be to be a mom for a while, right? Like when I'm a writer and I'm writing my book, my purpose was to write my book. When I wasn't feeling well, when my sister passed away, there's a lot of purpose in me grieving. So I think your purpose moves. And I think anyone who's looking for a fixed purpose is allowing their intellect to rule their decision-making about life. And they're looking through a lens of their mind and they're missing their heart. And I think they need to, you know, grab a little ladder and put it from their head to their heart. I think a fulfilling career is a matter of the heart. It's much more of an art than a science. I think getting to know yourself is what allows you to have fulfillment and purpose. So I would ask somebody right now, come up with a list of like people, places, friends that make you feel like yourself. Yeah. You know, I used to live in Los Angeles, and when I was really stressed, I would go to the beach. There was something about the ocean that just made me feel like me. So when life was a little much, I'd grab a journal, I'd put my feet in the sand, and I recalibrated. Other things that make me feel like myself are hip hop dance classes and my friends. And I have a lot of good friends, but there's a few that really make me feel myself in particular. So I think it's important to take note of where you feel alive, take note of where you feel yourself, and start, instead of saying, what's my purpose and what job title matches it, saying, what do I need to go do today to feel like myself? And when you get in the vibration of you, it feels good to feel good. And it starts to leak other places. And then you can kind of feel in your body what feels like a yes, what feels like a no, and decision-making becomes a lot easier and knowing your options become a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Another message I would have around that is just don't just do what you love, do what you are. Look at who you are as a person and build a career around that. What does that mean? Look at where your gifts are. And if you don't know what they are, ask people when they've seen you at your best. Ask for feedback. There's a lot of intelligence and feedback from people that you respect and trust.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about creating a positive self-image? Do you get people to kind of write that? Because I've read these books where they encourage you to write down who you want to become. Okay, so in 5 years or even in 1 year or even in 1 week, what kind of person do you want to become? Are you a believer in writing that down and almost manifesting that?
I mean, I think hold a vision, set a vision, be visionary with your life, create your life, but hold it lightly, you know, so that you don't hold on to a vision so tight that your hands don't have space for something else even better to come in. I think that you can't really know what you want until you've tried things on. The world is a pretty cool and big and fun place with a lot happening. And people are interesting. And you can, whenever life feels kind of dull for me, I just know I need to have more conversations. And conversations create clarity. And, you know, even if I'm walking my dog, I'll say to myself, like, who can I have a conversation with today? Because maybe that'll expand what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
It's really quite simple self-discovery when you think about it. It's taking in new information so that you can sift through it and feel like what feels right for you.
Mm. And my penultimate question. What's a piece of advice that you would give your younger self?
I don't know. I'd probably tell her like everything's made up, you know, like,
really?
Yeah, because I think like we live in a world where what we think, we, first of all, most of our thoughts are repeated thoughts. Mm-hmm. So we're in this like constant neural pathway where everything is just being repeated. And most of the things we think are not real. Like, you know, we think a lot about what people think of us. And the truth is most people are thinking about them and that's fine. That's great. You know? So I'd say everything is kind of made up, like, and so why not pick things that feel good? Why don't you make up winning thoughts? Why don't you pick what you want to think and be who you want to be? Because who you are moves. That's why your purpose moves. That's why it's such a lost cause to say, what is my one purpose? You know, you can have many.
And if people want to get in touch with you to maybe have you coach them or anything, how do they do that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a good starter would probably be my book or my podcast. It's called the U-Turn Podcast, two words, Y-O-U-Turn. And then my book is called U-Turn as well. Get Unstuck, Discover Your Direction, Design Your Dream Career. Available everywhere books are sold. It just came out in Asia last week. And and then I'm on Instagram at Ashley Stahl. Thanks for having me.
Amazing. No, thank you for coming on. And I just want to thank you for inspiring me, because I remember watching your podcast, listening to your podcast during a time where I think you were talking about something and it was so pertinent to me, and it inspired me then to watch your TEDx speech. So I'm glad we could link up and talk now. So thank you again.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you.